my bossy voice, although not very used to it. We have our first speaker will be Tom Faulkner from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, who will talk about universal holographic enablement for CFTs.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me and having me here. I'm going to talk about some work that I did in this paper here. There's some follow-up work that's very preliminary with Rob Lee, who's here in the audience, and some students. So the motivation is this relation between entanglement and geometry. So we know from ADS-CFT that gravity can emerge from just a purely quantum mechanical system. And that's really interesting. And recently, it's really interesting from this relation between quantum information and gravity because it relates various things that are natural on both sides of the correspondence. So for example, entanglement entropy is area. And there are some more things that are in order of increasing complexity. This first law of entanglement entropy implies Einstein's equations, and so forth. Of course, because I'm fairly simple-minded, I'm going to concentrate on the simplest version of this, which is the statement that entanglement entropy is equal to area via the Rutaki-Nagi formula. Okay, so here's Rutaki-Nagi. No one needs reminding of this, but let me go through it so I can just set up my conventions. We want to calculate entanglement entropy in a holographic CFT. So here's our holographic setup. We have some boundary theory on a constant time-like slice here. We imagine the Hilbert space is a tensor product of the degrees of freedom in region A and then everything outside. And then we take some state, which is the vacuum state typically, and then we trace over everything that's outside of A. And then we calculate the von Neumann entropy of this reduced density matrix, and that gives us the entanglement entropy. And the powerful idea of Ru and Takinagi is that this is related to some geometric quantity under the ADS-CFT map. So here is the bulk. This is the bulk gravitational theory that's meant to be dual to this boundary theory. And the idea is that you find some minimal surface that's anchored at the boundary of A. You calculate the area of that minimal surface, and then that's the entanglement entropy. Okay. But there's sort of a natural question, which is how general is this idea? And you might expect that a natural answer to that question is just this idea that entropy is equal to area only works for CFTs with some classical gravity dual. In particular, CFTs or quantum field theories, which have a large number of degrees of freedom and are very strongly coupled. So this is what we usually think of as sort of the requirements for having a classical gravity dual. And this maps to having, when do we expect this to work? We expect that we need a quantum field theory with a large number of degrees of freedom that maps to Newton's constant being small. And the very strong coupling requirement maps to having some local effective field theory for gravity in the bulk. But there are actually hints that it works beyond this. In particular, in 2D CFTs, you can give some constraints. You need a large C, so you need a large number of degrees of freedom, and a low-lying sparse spectrum, which actually doesn't preclude string theory, so this may violate this assumption, and you still have this entropy equals area. But 2D is somewhat special, so I want to make some progress in another angle here. So what I'm going to find in this talk about today is some calculable limits of entanglement entropy where the Rutaki-Nagi formula works for any CFT in any dimensions.
Sorry, Tom.
Do they have a sparse spectrum? What do you mean by free?
Take free symmetrical.
Oh, yeah, right. If you overfold, right.
It will
work. Well, yeah, I think probably the statement is that I can give you a bulk geometry whose area calculates the entanglement entropy of that theory.
But it's not clear that bulk geometry is the
But that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, there exists some metric in higher dimensions from which I can calculate the entanglement entropy. That's the only requirement. Good. Okay, so yes. So the structure of this talk is I'm basically going to give the results and explain what this universality is. And then at the last part of the talk, I'm going to go over the derivation, which is somewhat involved, so I'm not actually going to go through all the steps. But I think it's a little interesting, so I'll get into that later. But now let me just give some results. So I'm going to give a few examples. So the first example is deformed CFTs. So this is an independent interest in studying entanglement in deformed CFTs. So in particular, as has been shown by people in the audience, entanglement entropy provides RG monotones, so C functions. So these are functions which are defined sort of on the space of conformal field theories, which you can show always decrease under RG flow. So if I have a renormalization group flow from one UV CFT to an IR CFT, then this quantity is always decreasing. So you can construct these functions using entanglement entropy. So in particular in two dimensions and three dimensions. So for example, in three dimensions, the idea is you take the entanglement entropy of a ball-shaped region. It's very important that for most of this discussion, I'm going to be talking about ball-shaped regions. And then you calculate that, take some derivatives of it. Then you can prove, or Cassini-Horta proved, that the derivative of this function is less than zero via strong subadditivity and is equal to FUV at the UV fixed point and FIR at the IR fixed point. And this actually just proves this statement. If I think about the UV CFT as some kind of quantum critical point, say some lattice system, and let's just work in 2+1 dimensions for simplicity, we have some tuning parameter, and as a function of this tuning parameter T, the wave function of the ground state wave function of this system changes dramatically. Say on one side there's some symmetry broken phase, on the other side there's a gap phase, and in between there can be a quantum critical point. And so a quantum critical point has large quantum fluctuations in the ground state wave function. It has a diverging correlation length as you approach the critical point. And one way to characterize these fluctuations is with entanglement entropy. So in particular, if you calculate the entanglement entropy at the critical point, you find the following answer. You always find a divergent piece. So entanglement entropy is a UV-sensitive quantity. The divergence is proportional to the area, and there's the lattice cutoff here. And this is coming from short-range entanglement at the scale of at the lattice scale. And this exists in any of these phases. So it doesn't really tell us about the quantum critical point. But the interesting part is this constant piece here. And so these derivatives that were written down by Mark and Hong actually remove this divergent part, and you're just left with this constant piece. And if this is non-zero, then you either have a quantum critical point or you have a topological theory. So this is an interesting thing to consider. Now, if I consider slightly away from the critical point, then I have a finite correlation length. And now this function, this f of r, probes the crossover from the UV to the IR. So in particular, if I take the region of the size of this ball to be very small compared to the correlation length, then it's like I'm at the UV fixed point, and then that's my answer for F. But then if I increase R, then I start probing the infrared, and eventually, if it's a gapped phase, F should go to zero. And this is the picture that you expect. Now, the interesting thing that I want to tell you about today is that I can calculate one part of this picture, which is the leading correction here, as you move away from the UV fixed point. So F has this expansion in R, and so I can calculate this numerical coefficient and so forth. And in particular, the interesting thing about this calculation is that the way that I did it, I did it completely in using conformal field theory, but the computation directly maps to a classical GR problem in one higher dimension. And in that problem, entanglement entropy is equal to area. Okay. So let me be a little bit more precise about the results I want to advertise. So I'm taking a CFT, and I'm deforming the Hamiltonian by some relevant scalar operator with this dimension. The first claim is that I can do a field theory calculation which calculates the leading correction here, which goes like lambda squared. So it's quadratic in this coupling. So obviously I'm going to use perturbation theory to do this, second order perturbation theory. And then there's some numbers here. Now these numbers were actually previously found for a holographic theory by Hong Liu and Mark Mazet, but I'm going to do it for any CFT, and it's a universal answer. The second, even more powerful claim is that I can actually treat space-dependent couplings as well. So if I imagine deforming my Hamiltonian by some space-dependent lambda of x times the same relevant operator, then I can calculate the leading piece in the change in entanglement entropy from the UV fixed point at order lambda squared, and it's equal to the following. It's equal to the area of some metric, which is in one higher dimension. To construct that metric, you're meant to solve Einstein's equations coupled to a free scalar field, perturbatively about ADS in d plus one dimensions, where the mass of this scalar field is the usual relation between the masses and conformal dimensions in ADS CFT. You impose this boundary condition on the fields at the boundary. So as z goes to zero, this is the boundary. You demand that the scalar field goes like the coupling. So this is where the coupling appears, lambda of x. And that the metric is asymptotically ADS. Then this problem defines for me a metric in one higher dimension. And then the idea is I should calculate the change in the area of this Ru Takayanagi minimal surface. And at quadratic order, that's the change in the entanglement entropy. Okay. Importantly, I've set G Newton to zero. Basically, the reason I can do that is because G Newton cancels out in the final answer. The only independent parameter in this problem is the normalization of the two-point function of the operator O, and this can be fixed by studying the two-point function of this free scalar in ADS. I stated the problem. This is the problem, but this is exactly how you would calculate this quantity. This change in entanglement entropy at second order in a CFT with a classical gravity dual, but my claim was that it was for any CFT. Okay, so when I tell people this, there's usually two kinds of reactions. So the first reaction is you're living in a fantasy world. This is obviously wrong. I've been watching too many Disney movies with your daughter. The actual complaint is, This is outside the regime of validity of ADS CFT. So in particular, I didn't say anything about large n. So there should be strong. We believe there should be strong quantum corrections to the bulk result. I didn't take into account them, or my answer doesn't have them in it. And the other reaction is this is obviously correct. This is I'm more sympathetic to this reaction. In hindsight, when you do this CFT calculation, when you sit down and do it, you notice that the calculation actually only depended on two pieces of data from the CFT. It only depends on the two-point function of this relevant operator O and a three-point function. So a three-point function of the stress tensor and two O's. The two-point function of any operator in a CFT is fixed by conformal invariance up to normalization. And the three-point functions in a CFT are also fixed up to some discrete set of parameters. Here, for scalar operators, it turns out that there's only one parameter in the three-point function, and that's further fixed by the Ward identity, relating this to this. Okay, so there's only one parameter. So that means that, you know, when you calculate this, it's universal in any CFT. So once I fix the normalization, even if I calculate it, if I was powerful enough to take a gravitational theory with strong, with a sort of a strong quantum gravity limit and calculate the entanglement entropy in that theory, I would find the same answer as long as I take into account the normalization of this operator. And I guess the real surprise is, you know, after going through this, is really the easiest way to calculate this leading correction is with classical gravity. That's the easiest way to do it. You can do it in other ways, but it's the easiest way. So just to sort of hammer home this point of universality, there's an analogy here that I like. If you just think about entanglement entropy or anything like that, if I just think about CFT three-point functions and calculating them in ADS CFT, well, we know from conformal invariance that it's fixed up to a finite set of parameters. For three scalar operators of the same dimension, there's just one parameter, this C here. But I can also calculate this in ADS CFT. It's some Witten diagram where I integrate over some bulk point with some bulk to boundary propagators from x1 to x, and that's the leading correction. But we know that it has to give this form up to this constant. And in particular, if I calculate the quantum corrections, it also has to give this form up to renormalizing this constant. So the difference here, though, is that we're doing things in reverse. Here, you know, in this example, the CFT answer was known before, and then you check that ADS CFT is consistent with that, and that's a very basic check of ADS CFT. But here we're doing things in reverse. ADS CFT gave us the answer. Hong and Mark wrote down the first correction to this F function, and we knew that for holographic theories. And now we're just managing to check that in CFTs. So we're doing things the other way around, and that's the power of the Ryu Takenagi formula. It really makes these calculations much easier. Yes.
So, in this obviously correct way of looking at it, did we need all these symmetries you gave yourself, being in flat space and in ball shape?
Yeah.
Where did those enter?
They enter. You'll see when I go through the calculation. But I need the modular Hamiltonian to be a local operator. So it's only for good. Okay, so yes.
Do you see that the 1/n corrections have to vanish in the path to this answer? Or?
Well, I don't think they vanish. They give the same. They just renormalize. Yeah, yeah. I don't know how to see that. I mean, I could try to do that calculation, but it should work. It's just CFT symmetries. Yeah.
Basic kinematical sort of correspondence of symmetries and
yeah.
so forth, or much deeper sort of dynamical state.
Right.
So is this more like the former?
Yeah, so this is just kinematics. So at this stage, we're just probing. It turns out we didn't know this to begin with. But we're just probing these kinematical questions. Now, you know, there are more interesting dynamical questions that you could try to attack, but that's going to be harder.
But as you said, the reason this works, obviously, is because the ADS geometry construct is not the holographic dual in real sense. It's just an auxiliary construct to compute the answer.
Yeah, that's right. So the next thing that I'll just touch on, which is some follow-up work, which is we'd like to do the same kind of thing with a stress tensor deformation. And following the same logic that I told you, I haven't gone through the derivation yet, and I'll get to it. But we expect that the CFT answer should be fixed by the two-point function of the stress tensor and the three-point function of the stress tensor. So it turns out that there are three independent parameters in here. And so you might expect a similar kind of universality for this quantity. Actually, this turned out to be a little bit complicated to do. So let's focus on a sort of an easier problem, which is instead of Right, so which is the following, which is now I'm going to take this ball-shaped region and I'm just going to deform it a little bit. Okay. Now it turns out that you can. This is the same problem as studying a CFT with a deformation of the stress tensor, where I pick this H mu nu just to be some pure diffeomorphism given by some vector C, which pushes this surface around. Now, usually when you put a pure diffeomorphism into your theory, it vanishes just by conservation of the stress tensor. But in the presence of this entangling surface, it actually moves around the entangling surface, and it gives you a change in the entanglement entropy. So this is sort of a simplified problem here. We're not going to study the full space of deformations for the stress tensor. We're going to concentrate on a really simple subset. And then you can calculate a second order term just like I did for the scalar. And so the second order term is something called the entanglement density, where I take three regions A, B, C, and I calculate this quantity, which is actually just the strong subadditivity bound. This has to be positive by strong subadditivity. And then I expand it in small deformations around this ball-shaped region. And I define this thing called the entanglement density. Where delta R are these small deformations. Actually, again, you can prove this is universal in any CFT, and it takes the following form. And again, it was first predicted in holography to take this form. Where the answer just depends on one parameter. This one parameter is fixed by the stress tensor two-point function. And so it actually turned out that this quantity wasn't sensitive to all the data in the three-point function of the stress tensor. Good. So I want to contrast this universality with a different kind of CFT universality. One thing that people have talked about a lot about recently is in even dimensions, if you calculate the entanglement entropy of some region and you give it an expansion in the UV cutoff, so epsilon is a short distance cutoff, then you get the area law term as usual, and this is non-universal, but then you get a log term. And because it's a log term, as typically happens, log terms are the coefficient of log terms are universal. And this is related to the trace anomaly in the CFT. So this is in any even dimensions, but I've written the formula in four dimensions up to some numerical constants, which I'm not being careful about. This is also universal. So once I fix A and C, I should be able to calculate this quantity in any theory. So in a similar manner, it's universal. However, I want to contrast it with what I'm calculating, because this is a UV quantity. It's not actually sensitive to the bulk. So if you do this calculation in ADS CFT, you notice this term comes from a boundary term here. So I didn't say this before, but when you calculate this area, you find an infinite answer, and the way to regulate that is to cut this off at the boundary, and this is how you get these divergent terms. And when you do that in four dimensions, you find this log term. Whereas the quantities that I'm talking about, when you do the calculation of f of r or the entanglement density, you really notice that this is probing what's going on down here in the bulk. And so the things that I'm interested in are really these constant terms here. yeah.
Even dimensions, you get those.
But when you phrase it, so then you also get the log there?
No, well, for example, in the entanglement density, I was careful not to get that. If you take these regions not to be overlapping, then this quantity is actually UV finite. Okay, so this is just a finite term. So there's no, and similarly for this F function, you take the derivatives to remove the divergent terms.
Like, can you see that you are, I mean, is there some way that you can prove sort of looking formula from what you are doing?
I tried. It's a little bit complicated. Another thing that I should contrast this is with, I'm always working with ball-shaped regions or small deformations of ball-shaped regions. This is more powerful. This works for any region. Okay, good. And I should also mention, you know, there are other log terms like these corner terms that Rob has been discussing lately. And I think these sort of are similar to this, these kind of universal terms. This is sort of an aside. There's a different approach to this universality. So there's actually many recent papers that have observed similar kinds of universality. So the idea here is to study sort of a large class of gravitational theories. In particular, you take a gravitational theory and you add high derivative corrections. And that allows you to sort of explore the parameter space of potential ADS-CFT duals. And then you can calculate the entanglement entropy with these high derivative gravitational theories using generalizations of the Ruta-Kinagi formula. And for certain quantities, people always found the same answer. And so you might claim victory then. This is a universal quantity. It doesn't depend on all these other parameters. But you know, this argument is not quite a proof because there are quantum corrections. And I think that's why it's useful to pursue this CFT approach. There's actually a hybrid approach where you set up the CFT calculation and you see that it only depends on this discrete set of data. And so you match that data to some gravitational theory, and then you use the gravitational theory to calculate entanglement entropy. Because actually, it's much easier to calculate entanglement entropy with the gravitational theory. So that's an interesting hybrid approach. I'm not going to follow that. It's probably useful to think about that.
But that approach would basically say that once you identify what quantities you need to compute in the CFT,
yeah,
you hook up a toy model.
Which matches those parameters, and then. Your entropy, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I mean, this is solid. The hybrid approach, like it's watertight, but it's at this point, it's not quite satisfying. Now I'm going to get to the calculation. So let's take a deep breath and relax a little bit. So this is just going to be a sketch. So the most important tool for me, I've harped on about this, the fact that I'm only interested in ball-shaped regions, and it's for this reason. Okay, so firstly, the reduced density matrix you can always write as the exponential of some Hermitian operator. I'll call that operator HA, and it's sometimes called the modular Hamiltonian or the entanglement Hamiltonian. And so you can always do this for any reduced density matrix, but it turns out if you have a ball-shaped region and a CFT. So at zero coupling, then the modular Hamiltonian takes a really nice form. It's just the integral of a local quantity. It's an integral of the stress tensor with some function here. And so this was derived in this paper. And the basic idea is it's really a generalization of the Unruh effect in Rindler space. So the Unruh effect in Rindler space is relevant for calculating entanglement entropies for planar surfaces. So if I think about half of all space and I want to calculate the entanglement between A and A bar, then it's useful to sort of work with Rindler observers or work in Rindler coordinates. And so Rindler observers are uniformly accelerated in this x direction, which is in this direction here. And as such, they sort of asymptote to a light cone over here. And so they never have access. Because of that, they never have access to A bar. And all of, they should be completely described by the reduced density matrix, rho A. Then you can show, using sort of a Euclidean path integral argument, that the reduced density matrix has a simple form, which is just the exponential of minus kx, where kx is the generator of this boost. Yeah. It's not that surprising. These observers have a horizon, so they should see a thermal state, and this is the thermal state. It's a thermal state, but with respect to a funny Hamiltonian. Now, for a CFT, you can use a global conformal transformation. So, this is true for any relativistic theory, so any theory with a boost, with boost invariance in some direction. For a CFT, you can use a global conformal transformation that maps this half plane to a circle. And under this map, this operator, this boost operator, boost generator gets mapped to the entanglement, the module Hamiltonian. And so HA under this map is just what's known as a conformal boost generator, which is also a symmetry of this CFT vacuum. So let me give you some intuition for what this operator HA is. If I consider a finite conformal boost acting on, say, a local operator that's in the region A, so this is my local operator in the region A, I'm going to conjugate it by a unitary operator determined by HA, which is e to the I HAS. And the claim is that this operator is a local operator at a different point in the domain of dependence of A. So what's the domain of dependence of A? So if I take A and I consider this causal diamond region here, this is just the domain of dependence of A. I'm only drawing one of the spatial directions here, and this is time. So the claim is that this operator is a local operator at a different point, and that point is determined by a finite conformal boost in this direction. So you take this operator and you move it along these lines by some amount determined by this rapidity factor e to the s. And so we do that and we call this point xs, and then this operator is proportional to an operator, a local operator at a different point. And so this is sometimes called modular float. Yeah.
Some sort of evolutions, temporal evolution with a time translation given by the boost time.
Right.
But if you imagined sort of inserting some local operator as a sort of deformation as evolving, if you might imagine that to spread out and not be a local operator. So
well,
picture of time evolution,
it's not a local operator if you look at it from at a different time, but if you look at it at this time, it's a local operator. So I mean, it's the usual statement of time evolution, right? And you know, maybe it's more familiar. It's the usual statement of just boosts in relativistic theories. If I boost an operator, it moves it. And this is just a generalization of that. The slight difference is that it's only proportional to this operator. You get these annoying conformal factors as well. Good. So that was for a CFT, but we're not really interested. So I should say, you know, this is really powerful, and this allows you to make a lot of progress in calculating CFT entanglement entropies for ball-shaped regions. But now we want to do this for a deformed CFT. So what do I mean by that? So we're gonna take the Hamiltonian. This is not the modular Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian of the CFT, and we're going to deform it by some relevant operator, as I discussed before. And then you get a new ground state, and you can construct that new ground state in perturbation theory using a Euclidean path integral. And then with that new ground state, you can calculate the reduced density matrix, and that also has a perturbative expansion. So in particular, you're going to get a term proportional to lambda and a term proportional to lambda squared and so forth. So this series can be constructed using a Euclidean path integral, and this was really sort of pioneered by these guys. And then you want to take that delta rho and you want to plug it into this formula. So now it turns out when you do that, for a relevant scalar deformation, the first order term vanishes, and I'll explain why in a second. But at second order, there are two kinds of terms that look as follows. So the change in entanglement entropy from the vacuum entanglement entropy is the change in the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian minus this relative entropy piece. Actually, this is true generally, not just in a perturbative expansion. But it turns out that if you look at this first piece, this is sometimes called the entanglement first law because it relates an entropy to an energy, then at first order, so if I just plug in the change in the state delta 1, which is proportional to lambda, you can show that the first order term vanishes. The modular Hamiltonian in the CFT, which is what appears here, is just determined by the stress tensor. So this is a two-point function between the stress tensor and the relevant operator O, and that always vanishes in a CFT. So the first term that appears here is from this piece, and it's second order in lambda, and it's determined by a three-point function, a T O O three-point function. So this is going to be the claim that, that my answer depends on the T O O three-point function that comes from this piece here. The relative entropy is more complicated. But one thing we know is that relative entropy is positive. So as long as this is an analytic expansion, the first order term has to vanish. Because if it didn't, then I could change the sign, and then relative entropy wouldn't be positive. So it's true that the first order term vanishes. And so this is second order. But it's second order due to two of these terms. So delta 1 rho squared. Okay.
Could you just say some conformal field theory that T0 expectation is zero because the dimensions don't match? Is that why?
This is in flat space. So relativistic invariance just imposes that it should be zero.
What are you assuming about the state?
It's the tensor operator. Yeah, this is it.
How about you? You're assuming the vacuum state?
Vacuum state. This is in the vacuum state. This is a flat space vacuum state. So I'm doing, you know, this is a perturbative expansion. So at each point, I'm going to get correlation functions that are in the vacuum. Right. So the relative entropy term is in some sense most interesting, and it takes this form, trace rho A log rho A minus rho naught, where this is the CFT density matrix. And the real difficulty is this term here, log rho A. So if I expand rho A as rho naught plus delta rho, because these operators don't commute, it's actually non-trivial to do this expansion. So the first thing you might try to do is use the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula. But there's an infinite number of terms. And each of these terms naively contains a CFT endpoint function in flat space with n large. And this would seem to doom universality, right? So maybe it doesn't just depend on the two-point function and three-point function. But there's a trick. So the trick, which I'm sure I absorbed from papers by Cassini and Horta. I don't know which paper, but that's where I got it from. So you rewrite the log of rho A as the following integral. And then it's much easier to expand this guy. So in particular, the relative entropy term is just the following integral over this parameter beta with two delta rho's. Okay? You can rewrite that. I'm not going to go through this in detail. Essentially, by inserting complete sets of eigenstates of rho naught, so entanglement eigenstates, and then you do this beta integral, and then you do some Fourier transform on the entanglement eigenstates, and you come up with the following answer, where k is just some kernel. It's one over sinh squared s, something like that. Right. But here you see you still have two factors of delta rho, and then you have this conjugation. And so this is why I told you about this modular evolution, because it's going to become important. So the relative entropy term takes this form, as I just had. Now the Euclidean path integral argument gives you an expression for delta rho in terms of lambda, where you're integrating over the full Euclidean manifold. And that's just because you're doing, you're constructing the new ground state perturbatively using a Euclidean path integral. And so once you insert this into here, you see that this modular flow, this rho 0 to the is, rho 0 to the minus is, is acting on this operator O of x. And so all it does is shift this operator to another point, O of x, s. And at the end of the day, you have an integral over s and two integrals over the operator insertions times a two-point function at these locations. So at x1, after you do this modular flow by s, and x2. OK, so here I can claim victory. This is just the two-point function. It's a funny two-point function at funny points in space-time. But this, in principle, is enough to claim victory, especially given this hybrid approach.
We're not letting lambda be the dependent on position?
It can be, yeah.
It doesn't change anything.
Yeah, it's easiest to state if I only let it depend on space and not space-time, because then it's confusing when I'm calculating. But you can still even let it depend on space-time. But let's just think about potentially space couplings.
So if it depends on space-time, can you evolve within range and time?
Yeah, you can do all that. I didn't do that because it's just a few more bells and whistles, as you obviously know from your recent work, let me not complicate things right now. So we have this answer. Why stop here? It's a set of integrals over a CFT two-point function. I know what the CFT two-point function is. I can write down this function. It's like seven integrals or some large number of integrals. Why don't we try to do these integrals? I failed to do these integrals. But it turns out you can rewrite these integrals in a completely different way. And this is where I'm not going to go into too much detail, but this is what I'm going to claim. So the relative entropy term can be written as follows. So this is a bulk quantity. I'm going to define what it is in a second, but it's a bulk quantity. So what do I mean by that? So essentially, to this CFT, I can associate an ADS space. This ADS space is essentially purely kinematical. So it has the right isometries. But in this ADS space, now this conformal boost that I talked about, so this is the boundary here, this is the z direction, this is time, this is my causal diamond, my domain of dependence of A. I have this blue line, which is this conformal boost on the boundary. And associated to that, in the bulk, there's a boost isometry as well. And a finite transformation under this boost moves you along these red lines here. And so these red lines fill out what's known as the Rindler wedge, the ADS Rindler wedge. So in particular, this is this causal region here between the domain of dependence of A and the minimal surface here, which is this Rutaki-Nagi surface that goes into the bulk. Then this quantity here is just the Hamiltonian or the charge associated to this bulk isometry for a free scalar field in the bulk. That's all it is. Evaluated on some particular classical field configuration phi, which is determined by some horrible integrals. It's an integral over the boundary manifold of the coupling times the bulk to boundary propagator. So, ADS essentially popped out. I saw it pop out because I saw these bulk to boundary propagators pop out. And they naturally appear in these integrals. And so the final answer that I'm going to write down for this relative entropy term is an integral over the bulk stress tensor for this free scalar field, which is determined by this. Okay, so you see, this is a whole mess of integrals. There's two integrals, two space boundary integrals for each of phi, because the stress tensor is quadratic in phi. The free bulk stress tensor is quadratic. And then there's another set of integrals over this region sigma here. So the claim is, this set of horrible integrals is equal to this set of horrible integrals. And so once you see that, it's kind of obvious what to do. Putting things together, the change in entanglement entropy takes this nice form. It has this first law piece, but it also gets this piece from the bulk, which is also sort of the expectation value of the bulk modular Hamiltonian. And now it's easy to see how you show that entropy is equal to area. In the final form is the change in the CFT form is the change in entanglement entropy is this first law piece plus this integral. It turns out that if I study any metric fluctuation in ADS, it satisfies the following equation. So I'm imagining taking ADS and perturbing it now. You can show that the metric fluctuation satisfies the change in the area due to that metric fluctuation is equal to the integral, this is also over sigma, I should have written that there, of the left-hand side of Einstein's equations, plus some boundary term, which depends on the fall off at the metric at the boundary. And if you look at these two equations, they're essentially identical. If I demand that Einstein's equations is satisfied with this stress tensor as the source, then you can show that these terms are equal, and then you're left with the statement that the change in entanglement entropy is the change in area. So basically, the story is we've introduced a metric by hand, but it's a nice metric. If we demand that it satisfies Einstein's equations, then it has to couple to this stress tensor, then it has to encode the full CFT entanglement entropy. Here's some sort of vague intuition for what this calculation is telling us. This S interval that appeared sort of in a funny way, it's kind of like a smearing function. You evolve this operator in this causal diamond and you integrate over it. And it's, in some sense, it's allowing us to reach into the bulk. So it's reconstructing fields in the bulk. And I think this is really important. It's essential to include this effect to derive the universal CFT terms that I'm talking about. It might not be necessary to include this to find log epsilon UV divergent pieces. This is a comment because these authors don't include this S interval, and they still find some consistent results related to UV divergences, which I'm a little confused by.
So S, remind me, was the parameter to drive the resolvent per version of the 1 hour, because we're going to get beta integral after
some Fourier. Right. Yeah. It appears like this. You can think of this as sort of passing from old-fashioned perturbation theory, where beta is like an energy, to time-dependent perturbation theory, where S is a time.
So this is a simple parameterization of...
that's right.
This is vaguely reminiscent of attempts in the past to write down ADS viewers for free field theory by Gopakumar.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, someone told me this before, maybe you. Yeah.
Is like this.
I see. Okay. This S doesn't actually appear. It's not one of the final sort of bulk coordinates that appears. It's not this S. It's some Schwinger parameter, some other Schwinger parameter you introduced along the way.
S integral only appears because you're considering a sphere, but for a plane, for half a plane, it wouldn't appear, right?
Or no, it does appear for half a plane. Yeah. So for half a plane, if your deformation preserves relativistic invariance, there are other methods to calculate this, and you don't have to go through this. But if it doesn't, then you have to confront this. Okay. So that's the end of my talk. Here are the conclusions. I derived the universal contribution to entanglement entropy for CFTs. All of these results are going to be for small deformations of ball-shaped entanglement entropies at some order. Now, of course, I didn't say it, but the second-order term depends on the 2 and the 3-point function. The third-order term is going to depend on the 3 and the 4-point function. The 4-point function is not universal. It's not kinematical. And so at that point, you're going to differ, and it's going to depend on the theory. So it depends, and it agrees with holographic theories in what I think is a very non-trivial way. And really, the most natural way to derive all of these things involves this formula. That's the end. Thank you.
Yeah. So if I was in particular considering the perturbation of the metric itself, so that my O is actually T itself.
Yeah.
Then is it universal to all orders?
No.
So what order? It's still universal.
The second order.
Even though I just get stress tensor for that.
Right, which is non-trivial.
2D would be.
Yeah, in 2D.
Yeah, sure. But that probably goes under some other results if you put the right.
The failure for free fields of these or something?
Free fields have a very specific conformal dimension, so I don't know, there are some issues with that, but in principle it should work.
Because of this non-stationarity or...
Good. I didn't mention that. This is I should have mentioned that. This is the leading term. The thing that I calculated here, let's in this language, it's a leading term that you find as long as the conformal dimension is bigger than d over 2.
Yeah.
If it's less than d over 2, there's another non-analytic term that is larger than this. Because it's non-analytic, I can't see it yet. But you see, in this calculation, when you go towards d over 2, you see an II divergence, which is sort of suggestive that there should be some non-analytic. But yeah, that is from there. The non-stationarity is from there. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't understand that comment. So maybe the hybrid approach, delta less than d over 2 won't be a problem.
Well, the assumption is that it is a perturbative extension. That's always the assumption when you're doing perturbation theory. It might may not be. So there might be terms that are lambda to some funny power, in which case you have to read some perturbation theory. There's something special.
But is it clear why you need to read some for delta less than d over 2?
It's clear from ADS-CFT, it's not so clear from... Oh, yeah, there's an II divergence that appears that is suggested. Which apparently, yeah. But in ADS-CFT, it's clear of why. But I can tell you about that. Yeah.
Is there a similar universality statement for states? I mean, instead of perturbing Hamiltonian, so if I just...
Yeah.
Have a state with some operator expectation values.
I think if your state takes this form, then yes. Where this is maybe some operator acting on the vacuum. But it has to take this form. It can't be an operator acting on the vacuum. It has to be perturbatively close to
right.
The vacuum.
And does the universality would extend a second order, think?
Definitely.
And then what would the statement be? So again, for ball-shaped regions, the entanglement entropy would depend.
Well, you might be referring to the information metric. So the relative entropy term at second order is the information metric. And that, for this state, I think, would just be what you would get in ADS-CFT. For free field.
Let's see. I guess I'm wondering whether the answer... So the answer at second order, would that depend on... On the just the one-point function or the two-point function?
On the two-point coefficient.
Because I guess even with the one-point function, I can calculate the metric.
Oh, this is for stress testing? If I did a T?
Yeah.
Yes. That's the first law piece, yes. Yeah, there's a two-point function in stress testing. So there is a first order piece that I didn't talk about. But that's also universal.
Okay. Yeah, I'll probably ask you
yeah.
in more detail.
More questions? We convene at 4:00, but let's thank the speaker again.